This is DNA And, the podcast bringing you the latest science and innovation in DNA and our health. Today we're exploring DNA and COVID-19. Together with two expert guests, we will discuss how we can read human DNA and virus RNA to better understand the pandemic and its effect on our health.
Okay, so welcome back to part two of DNA and COVID-19. So in part one, we talked about genetic information in human DNA and how this can affect our likelihood of getting an infection from SARS-CoV-2, but also the severity of the symptoms of this infection.
Yes, all very important. But today we're moving on to the genetic material of the virus itself. So the coronavirus genetic material is RNA. So today we're going to be talking to Dr. Matthew Forbes and Dr. Lucy Van Dorp about genomic surveillance of SARS-CoV-2 and also reservoirs of coronavirus in animal populations and zoonotic potential. So first, I'm really excited to introduce our guest, Dr. Matthew Forbes. Matt completed his PhD at Birkbeck and UCL, which is University College London, and now works as a principal bioinformatician at the Genomic Surveillance Unit, the Wellcome Sanger Institute in Cambridge, UK. So it's a delight to have you on the podcast, Matt. I can imagine the last few years with this pandemic has been pretty busy for you. Could you maybe give us a quick overview of your role?
Sure. So thanks for having me, first of all. So I joined the Sanger Institute in September 2020 as initially as a genomic surveillance data analyst. Initially, I spent my time investigating the distribution of SARS-CoV-2 variants in space and time and working on the idea of a genomic early warning system. But then the focus of our work really changed with the arrival of the Alpha variant, and we really started looking more at variants themselves and how they manifested. From then, SARS-CoV-2 sequencing really began to scale up, and Sanger became the main sequencing hub for the COG-UK consortium. At our peak, we were sequencing around 65,000 samples every single week. And so the priority was then to ensure we could provide good data at high speed. Our experience with SARS-CoV-2, coupled with the previous decade or so of experience doing genomic surveillance of malaria, then led to the formation of the Genomic Surveillance Unit as a formal entity in 2022. I now work within the data analysis and engineering team, where we have a group of talented bioinformaticians working to produce scalable bioinformatics pipelines and deliver data-driven insights for the surveillance of diseases such as malaria and SARS-CoV-2. And we're looking to expand into new surveillance areas, such as respiratory viruses outside of SARS-CoV-2, like influenza and RSV, or also potentially vectorborne viruses such as dengue and chikungunya.
So genomic surveillance is a really important tool to help us fight back against the pandemic. And since this is a DNA podcast and we love talking about RNA and DNA, Matt, you were a co-author on a 2021 Nature paper titled Genomic Reconstruction of the SARS-CoV-2 Epidemic in England. So I think you might be the right person to explain to our listeners what genomic surveillance is and why is it so important.
A key facet of natural selection is this idea of survival of the fittest. Evolution of random genetic mutation will lead organisms to acquire traits which help them to thrive in their environment and navigate selection pressures. In the course of our response to the pandemic, we placed certain selection pressures on the virus, including non-pharmaceutical interventions such as lockdowns and pharmaceutical interventions such as drugs and vaccines. And genomic surveillance is a tool which we can use to get ahead of evolution. By spotting genetic variation in pathogen populations and assessing their growth potential, we can get into a much better position to respond to new threats and gain a better understanding of what's coming down the track.
Nice. And what are the potential benefits of being able to do this?
In the pandemic, the main use of this was to be able to identify new variants and assess their potential impact before those impacts were felt in earnest. So, for instance, we could see in the November 2020 lockdown that although cases overall were decreasing, a particular variant, now known as Alpha, was actually growing in the southeast of the country. And once the lockdown was released, we could see that this variant was spreading quickly from the southeast across the entire country. Having the information from genomic surveillance allowed our partners in government to be able to understand what was causing this heightened spread. Not that it was necessarily due to behavioral factors, but potentially it was more to do with this more transmissible strain.
I can imagine this information was really important to employ the focused restrictions. So it was locked down not just of the whole country, but of specific areas. So we had the tiered system in the UK. And I think, at least from my perspective, that was much better, right, than locking down the whole country if there's an outbreak just in the southeast, for example, would you say?
Yeah, so I'd say it's not my place to comment on the effectiveness of interventions. It was our job to provide genomic data and not to advise what to do with the data. But what I can say is that when we reported our 2021 paper, we looked at the extent to which the alpha variant represented a real step change in the spread of SARS-CoV-2. In November 2020, the government ordered the second national lockdown in England. However, some rules were relaxed compared to the first national lockdown, such as schools remaining open, pubs and restaurants being allowed to serve takeaways. What we could see from our surveillance at the time was that this was sufficient to reduce the spread of the variants that were previously circulating. However, at the time, the alpha variant was also slowly increasing owing to its higher transmission rate, which indicates that it was not being contained by this particular lockdown.
Yeah, and it was really important to know at the time, is this new strain serious? How worried do I need to be about it? The risk of reinfection, is it higher or lower, for example? So it's really important information.
Yeah, and talking about different variants or strains, I need your help in understanding the difference. So these are the Alpha, Delta, Omicron, etc., right? How do you actually define a new variant? What's going on behind the scenes of that?
Oh, and who comes up with the name?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. So this was a very important topic for enabling communication and collaboration with regarding how we term variation in SARS-CoV-2. The definition of variants relies on the concept of a phylogenetic tree, which in essence is a representation of the relationships between sequenced organisms.
I guess you can think of it like a wider family tree, maybe.
Yeah, sure. So, but let's imagine we have a tree where we have branches and twigs that are evenly distributed. Now let's imagine that one part of the tree starts developing more and more twigs and branches at a much higher rate compared to the rest of the tree. And we would then say that it represents a new clade. But we still needed to figure out how to designate these clades. So much of the community came to use the Pango nomenclature for defining clades. But then in May 2021, the World Health Organization designated a much more simplistic nomenclature for looking at variants of concern. And these are variants which were known to be particularly of interest in terms of public health. So this is how the complicated representations such as B117 then became Alpha, B1617.2 became Delta, and B11529 became Omicron, and so on and so forth.
Can I ask, how is SARS-CoV-2 sequenced for genomic surveillance?
So one of the main challenges in sequencing for variation in viruses such as SARS-CoV-2 is that we will have a saliva sample, and from that you'll have potentially billions of what we call reads or small pieces of sequencing data. But for one, we can only sequence a small fraction of them. And not all of those reads will actually be related to what we're interested in this case, SARS-CoV-2.
So some of them could be your lunch, for example.
Yes, some of them could be your lunch. Some of them could be you. So what we really need is a way to concentrate our samples to the genetic material we're actually looking for variation in. And there are a broad range of methods which we can use for that. In SARS-CoV-2, one of the most commonly employed is a protocol called ARTIC. So this uses a methodology known as amplicon sequencing. So you can think of amplicon sequencing as basically, we know approximately what different parts of the genome will look like. So then what we're basically doing is we are taking the parts of the genome the parts of the genetic information that look like SARS-CoV-2, and we're copying it so that we're making sure we have much more of this stuff that we're really interested in compared to the other stuff that we're not interested in.
Can I add to that? So as another analogy, yeah. It goes from being 90% DNA of you and your lunch and a few percentage that was SARS-CoV-2 and you amplify it and it goes to being 90% of the SARS-CoV-2 genetic material. So that makes up the majority of the sample and then it's easier to take it out.
Exactly that. And that means that we can actually much more easily dig into that and we have enough information to see where we actually have variation. Another technique which is under active exploration is a technique called bait capture. If you imagine you're going fishing, You might tailor your choice of bait to the type of fish you want to catch. With bait capture sequencing, we use a similar concept to throw in bait sequences. If we're looking to pull out of a complex sample sequences that we're really interested in, such as respiratory viruses, we can basically throw in some sequences that almost act like a bait, basically lifts these sequences out. This has advantages over the amplicon sequencing, as it's such as flexibility and lower sensitivity to mutations. But amplicon sequencing can often have the edge, especially when you have low amounts of genetic material.
Yeah, really interesting. I just think it's amazing that humanity effectively came together during the pandemic and all of these scientific advances came out of it. And now we have amazing tools to fight back, like we've been saying. We had the front line, we had the NHS, but we also had the scientists behind the scenes.
I will just say, it's important to note as well, it wasn't just scientists. There was a lot, all of the people behind the scenes, because really and truly, this was a major project. And to do that, you need a lot of expertise across a lot of different areas to connect all the dots.
Thank you for saying that. It's good to have you on the podcast as someone who's been more involved in seeing these efforts during the pandemic. So it's also equally as important to try and predict when these next pandemics are going to happen and to try and avoid them and to utilize the tools that we've developed. So we're going to be talking to Dr. Lucy Van Dorp next, who's going to tell us about coronaviruses in animals and zoonotic potential and how we track them. So that's going to be really interesting. But just wanted to say thanks again, Matt, so much. This has been incredibly interesting and really insightful to be able to listen to your experience.
No worries. Thank you very much for having me.
Okay, so we're delighted to welcome Dr. Lucy Van Dorp onto the podcast. So Lucy is a UKRI Future Leaders Fellow at the University College London, or UCL Genetics Institute, where her lab researches patterns in viral and bacterial pathogens by analysing DNA and RNA with some very high-tech computational methods. Lucy, would you say that's a good summary?
Yes, yeah, it's really nice to be here. I think that's a good summary. We're really interested in how we can use the power of big genetic data sets to inform us on what are the factors that really underlie the success of different microbial organisms, and mostly looking at pathogens.
And Lucy, you were awarded the prestigious Balfour Lecture last year by the Genetic Society. So congratulations, by the way.
Thank you.
And that lecture is awarded to mark the contributions to genetics of an outstanding young investigator. I had the pleasure of being in the audience for your lecture, which is what inspired this podcast episode. So can I start by asking, how did you get into this area of research?
I guess I was always interested in biology and particularly drawn to questions around evolution that I developed in my sort of A-level studies and in my undergraduate studies. And it soon became apparent to me that genetics gave you a toolkit where you could start to actually try and map and understand evolution in different systems. So this sort of led to me wanting to pursue a career in genetics. And I actually originally did my PhD in human genetics. So I was working on methods to infer patterns of human migration and human demographic history. I then moved into a postdoctoral position. And in that position, I started to apply that same skill set to microbial diversity and to pathogens. And this really led me to becoming very interested and excited about how we can use computational methods in genomics to inform microbial evolution at many different scales. We're pretty much a fully computational lab, and we design methods and work on methods that can help us to uncover quite deep events in pathogen histories, but also right the way through to tracking kind of modern disease outbreaks, epidemics, and even pandemics.
Yeah, that's quite interesting. So earlier in the episode, we talked about the virus SARS-CoV-2, which caused the recent pandemic, although many people will refer to it using coronavirus, which is quite funny, right? It's like referring to someone using only their surname. So the coronavirus family includes many unique viruses. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think you're right. We've had such a centric view of SARS-CoV-2 as a coronavirus that we tend to forget that this is just one species in what's really a very large family of viruses. They're known as the coronaviridae. They have within them four different genres. So there's a lot of diversity there. They're the alpha, beta, gamma, and delta coronaviruses, the Sarbica viruses. So there's a lot of kind of taxonomic structure within the wider family. So the coronaviruses comprise species that can infect economically important livestock. There are veterinary importance. Good examples are sort of porcine or pig coronaviruses. These can often cause very major gastric infections and high morbidity and mortality outbreaks in pig farms, for instance. And I think also we tend to forget that, of course, there are other human coronaviruses, so coronaviruses that are very good at infecting humans. We've seen those of epidemic or pandemic potential. So SARS-1 is a good example that was responsible for the sort of 2003 or so SARS epidemics, of course, SARS-CoV-2, and also MERS, Middle Eastern Respiratory Syndrome virus. And there's also a really interesting set, I think, of four species that are known to circulate endemically in humans. They circulate and perhaps cause maybe 10 to 30% of common colds. And I think, again, this is a bit underappreciated that many of us very likely had coronavirus infections, coronavirus-caused colds before the COVID-19 pandemic.
So I wanted to bring it back to the idea of coronavirus reservoirs in animals. Could you give us an overview of why it's important to study these reservoirs?
Yeah, so I think in terms of our understanding of kind of emerging zoonotic disease, we have an expectation that there are large reservoirs of viruses in animals. For SARS-CoV-2 or the coronaviruses, I mentioned pigs, but they're really found across mammalian diversity, also very significant avian outbreaks of coronaviruses. So have a very broad host range. And so, of course, understanding how the virus adapts or perhaps doesn't even need to adapt to infect many of these different species might be a really good way of predicting or understanding the risk of other coronaviruses causing infections in major human or animal groups, but also to better understand just how coronaviruses evolve in general. So we've done quite a bit of work in this area. Some of that has been looking for new coronaviruses through kind of surveying wildlife, for instance. But also we've been very interested in what SARS-CoV-2 tends to do when it spills over from humans into animals, which is something which is really common. We've seen time and time again. In fact, at this point in time, there have been infections of SARS-CoV-2 across nearly every mammalian order. And probably the best known examples of that are infections in mink farms. And there's also very significant reservoirs in white-tailed deer. And quite often in the context of studying these, we're interested in potential for viral adaptation, but also whether we can use approximations for evolution in different systems to better understand what might pose a risk in the future.
Oh, yes, you mentioned the bats. I wanted to ask you about the study. So this is something that was quite exciting. Is this 2023 paper, which was published in Nature? So there you explored bat species in the UK and coronaviruses. One take-home message was that the UK bats have coronaviruses with zoonotic potential. So I have two questions here. One is, how does this type of study happen? And should we be avoiding bats?
So I guess this is what I think is a reasonably good example of a study where you can target genomic surveillance to an animal or species reservoir that you think might pose a threat. And of course, at the point in time we started the work in the peak of the COVID-19 pandemic, bats were obviously high in the public agenda. Bats, of course, had quite a bad rap of lately. They're really seen as a very high-risk threat. So I was really brought in much more downstream. This was work that was led by Vincent Savalainen in Imperial, and he forged a network with the UK Bat Conservation Trust to potentially screen and sample fecal droppings from bat roosts. And that's quite important that we were looking at bat roosts and fecal material, because bats are, or many species of bats, most are endangered. And so we didn't want to be using a sampling technique that would be interacting with the bats too intensively, and instead we could sample their fecal material. So what we did, and this was aided by the UK Bat Conservation Trust or the UK Bat Trust, was to obtain fecal material from a number of sites across the UK. 48 different samples were taken, and this corresponded to 17 or 16 of the 17 bat species that are known to breed within the UK. So we nearly got all of them. And then the next question is, what viruses are there? So we used an approach called metatranscriptomic sequencing. So this is sequencing all of the RNA in this case that was present within the fecal droppings, and simply used all of that collection of genetic material to say what viruses are present. We found an awful lot, and amongst those were indeed some coronaviruses. We know that there are extensive coronavirus reservoirs within bats. And so we could then take the RNA, the genomic data that we'd obtained from these fecal droppings, to try and reconstruct the sequences of the coronaviruses that we found. So we were able to identify 9 different coronavirus observations within those bat fecal material. So should we be worried about the bats, which is what you asked? We then tried to characterize these viruses, and particularly focused on those 4 because of the close relationship to circulating or epidemic SARS viruses. So firstly, we looked for genomic similarity over the receptor. So this is the spike protein of the coronaviruses, to try and understand the homology that we might see related to other coronaviruses that infect humans. And then very importantly, we then went to a laboratory setup. This was work led by Tom Peacock, Purbright Institute, to ask the question, if we construct the spike protein sequence that we find within these bat coronaviruses and try to experimentally infect human cell lines, are they able to infect human cells? And we did this using something called a pseudovirus system. So this is perfectly safe. The virus can't replicate, but it does allow you to quantitatively assess the entry efficiency, so how well this virus spike protein would be able to enter human cells. And we actually found, of the four we looked at, there was one where we were able to get it to infect human cells. This we could actually only achieve when we amplified. So we used kind of high levels of the human receptor, the ACE2 receptor, to allow cell entry. And actually, when we have endogenous levels, so typical levels of that receptor, that this particular virus was no longer able to infect. So here I think we have probably an example where we have at least one species that we've recovered that can't right now infect human cells, but perhaps isn't not that many mutations away from being able to do. So this is a case where I think we can use an approach where we use some surveillance, we use some sequencing, and then we use appropriate kind of functional tests to be able to risk stratify a kind of newly detected viral threat.
That's also interesting. I wanted to also mention that it works both ways, right? And I also read that humans can actually infect animals quite a lot with our viruses. So did you find any evidence of that? Was that something you could look for as well?
Yeah, absolutely. Quite recently, actually last week, we've had a paper out that's been looking at trying to reconstruct the kind of the boundaries and the crossing of host boundaries that viruses go through at a global scale. And this was work led by PhD student Cedric Tan, who went through the painstaking task of analyzing or downloading and assessing the 12 million or so viral sequences that are currently available for kind of researchers to analyze. Looking at those, we then tried to identify firstly groups of viruses that could be grouped together in a kind of non-taxonomically informed way. So that allowed us to analyze 32 different viral families, of course, including the coronaviruses and other major viruses of importance. And then we tried to reconstruct where we would see spillover events between animals and humans based on that very large data set of viral sequences. And what was really interesting is that we found that most of the time we tended to see spillover events from humans into animals as opposed to the other way around. So we saw that was about two times as likely as from animals into humans. So this is the process of anthropognosis as opposed to zoonosis. It's the giving back of viruses, in this case, from humans into animals. And I think that's quite important. Of course, humans are just one part of a kind of nexus of microbial flow that's occurring between different species, but we're actually probably quite an important one. We have big effective population sizes. We're all over the globe. We trade, we import, we grow things in conditions that perhaps we shouldn't.
So you mentioned that you found these viruses that could potentially be a few mutations away. And at this point, my question, is there a way to quantify how many mutations away that might be?
Yeah, really important question. And it was actually a bit of a surprise to us that in terms of looking just at the genomics of those four particular Sarbica viruses that we followed up on, we wouldn't have necessarily predicted using just the genomic data that this was the one that was closest to infecting humans. And so I think this is actually a case where being able to do that risk stratification probably always will need a functional component. And the challenge there is being able to do this in a tractable and efficient way so that many samples can be screened at once. I think the genomics can obviously add a lot in terms of being able to say, okay, here is where we see that there are potential threats. But clearly there's more to be known or understood. At the same time, there was some work quite early on in the pandemic that looked at predicting the binding potential of the spike protein to different animal ACE2 receptors. And all of those types of studies have actually found that, yeah, this is a virus that probably doesn't need to adapt hugely to be able to infect very well across mammals. And then that came to be true. So that there is obviously value in using this type of approach. But I think a joint effort is probably what's required across disciplines, of course.
Yeah, I see. So from our conversation until now, what I get is that for a virus to cause an epidemic, there has to be both genetic and environmental factors. Am I right?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, you of course need the actual ability to enter a cell. That has to be a prerequisite. That's a biological constraint. If that can't happen, then simply you won't have the ability to establish infection. I think that can happen sometimes in different settings. So perhaps in immunocompromised individuals, it might be easier, or there might be cases where a virus or bacteria or whatever type of pathogen can spill over, but doesn't necessarily go on to be able to cause, say, human-to-human transmission. But then, of course, you need that to happen in the first place. And for that to happen, you need contact between a particular animal and a human. And as I mentioned, humans are everywhere. We're really good at moving around. So that's perhaps not so much of a constraint. But it is important to think about when we're thinking about where we're creating more contacts between humans and animals, where there could be scope for viral spread. I think in general, my line of research is probably missing some of the more ecological parameters that are very important. Where do we have these contacts? And also thinking forward to how do things like urbanization or deforestation actually change those contact rates between humans and animals, and what does that mean in terms of risks of humans catching things from animals, but of course also animals catching things from humans.
So it seems like there are other coronaviruses out there which may one day spill over into humans. Would you say a take-home message is that we need to learn from the SARS-CoV-2 pandemic and be better prepared for the next time this happens?
Yeah, I think so. And that's not to take away from efforts around pandemic preparedness pre-COVID-19, but I think we are now equipped with a huge body of knowledge as a result of our response to the pandemic, what went well, what didn't. So I think it would be naive to think that there won't be another pandemic. It is essentially a matter of time. And so thinking about the useful deployment of some of these tools, and I think genomics now will be part of that toolkit, but perhaps isn't not the only part of that toolkit, is going to be really important. And there are many trade-offs to be weighed. There's obviously the fundamental research, there's the ability to inform public health measures, but also there's economic arguments about where the best choice of resource is for things like supporting vaccine efficacy. I think, yes, certainly there needs to be some discussions. And I think as we come out of the post-pandemic fatigue and the period of coming back into a more normal existence, then this is the time for reflection and to think about what would be appropriate strategies going forward.
Okay, well, I think unfortunately that's all we have time for, but thank you very much, Lucy, for talking to us. Of course, it's impossible to cover all of the interesting research in a short interview, so we'll be sure to share some links on our website and social media for any listeners who want to read some more about Lucy's research, and I would definitely recommend it. So Lucy, do you have anything to add or any take-home messages?
Only to say thank you for having me. A nice little opportunity to showcase what we can do with genomics and the importance of thinking about infectious disease as a broad connected system between animals and humans.
Okay, that was very exciting. I'm very happy we did those two interviews. In this two-part episode, you've learned how studying genetic variation, not only in human DNA, but also in virus RNA, can help us to avoid adverse health outcomes from viral epidemics, but also help us to track them and also prevent future epidemics from spreading out.
Yes, those were two amazing interviews. Thank you so much to Matt and Lucy. And we're going to be sharing some more information about their work. So do keep an eye out on our social media channels at DNA and Pod with and spelt A-N-D and a capital P for Pod. And please do stay tuned for the next episode. So in the next episode, we're going to be talking about something called epigenetics, which are marks on DNA, and how they influence how we have babies. So why we need a male and a female to come together to have offspring because of these chemical tags on DNA, something called imprinting. So please do stay tuned and look forward to that.